Welcome to the Perp Web Podcast, hosted by Joe Bosch.
We're going to do the best we can. I don't have any disclosures, and I made the slides a little bit easier today, Joe. A lot of them are going to have everything they need on them. So what are the main issues when you look at, you know, the difference of managing your patient with alpha-SAT or pH-SAT? Well, we have stroke, cerebral, and cardiac dysfunction are common after, like you were saying, Joe, after complex cardiac surgery using hypothermic bypass and cardiac surgery using deep hypothermic circulatory arrest. Hypothermic bypass induces changes of the pH and of the PCO2, something I think you alluded to. The pH affects intracellular function and regeneration of cells after ischemia. PCO2 affects cerebral blood flow, as you know, as well as the speed and homogeneity of the cooling when you're doing these circ arrest cases. Excuse me. So the neurological dysfunction after cardiac surgery, right? You have global ischemia, right? You have circulatory arrest, but you also have focal ischemia, like as in a stroke. Embolization of the atherosclerotic material from the aorta or the arch vessels can break off and go upstream. You have risk factors like age, diabetes, hypertension. And then reduced cerebral blood flow reduces the risk of embolization, but increases the risk of hypoperfusion. So we're beginning to see the pluses and minuses are going to come clear more and more of pH-SAT versus alpha-SAT. So when we look at brain physiology, the brain is 2% of the total body weight, but needs and requires 15% of our resting cardiac output. It consumes 20% of our total body oxygen consumption, and the cerebral metabolic rate is related to the oxygen consumption. Those two have to be in line with each other. And it averages about 50 milliliters per minute in adults, and the greatest needs are in the gray matter. So when we look at neurological dysfunction with circulatory arrest, normothermia, brain injury occurs at about 4 to 4.5 minutes at normal temperature. Hypothermia, 18 to 20 degrees, like you mentioned, Joe, obviously allows for much longer periods of that lack of perfusion. Most patients tolerate deep hypothermic circulatory arrest up to about 30 or 40 minutes without neurologic dysfunction. Greater than 60 minutes, the majority of patients will definitely suffer irreversible brain injury. But like you said, Joe, you really like to keep it closer to that 30 to 35. So if we look at our cerebral metabolic rate and how it drops in proportion with hypothermia, here's a slide, and I put here in red 37 degrees along the bottom, and the cerebral oxygen consumption along the y-axis is about 1 milliliter per 100 grams per minute of cerebral brain mass at 30. And you look at the blue line that I put there, way down at 18 degrees, this goes down to almost 0.1. So this is, if you want to have some idea how we came up with the 40 or 45 minutes of safe circulatory arrest time, this gives you a good rule of thumb. If it's 4 minutes of safe circulatory arrest time at 37, it's 1/10.
What happened to John? Oh, John, you're... Uh-oh, did we lose him?
Awesome. Oh. Did it? I'm still here.
Yeah, there you are. You're back.
You still hear me?
Yeah, we lost your voice.
So can you hear me? Okay, yeah. So the when you go down to, say, 17 or 18 degrees, this goes down to 1/10 the cerebral oxygen consumption at 37 degrees. So if you're safe at 4 minutes at 37, you're relatively reasonable that you're going to be safe for 40 minutes down at about 17 or 18 degrees. So cerebral autoregulation, so CBF, it's tightly coupled to cerebral metabolic demands. It's constant over a wide range of perfusion pressures, but cerebral autoregulation is maintained in moderate hypothermia, somewhere about 28 degrees and above, it's maintained its autoregulation pretty well. But when you get down below 22 degrees, which is usually your profound circulatory rest and below, your autoregulation becomes impaired. So what I was just saying about blood pressure, so here's a slide that shows cerebral blood flow on the left and blood pressure along the bottom. And it's kind of giving you an idea of the ability of your cerebral autoregulation. And basically it maintains its autoregulation generally accepted at a pressure of 50 and above. And it gets out of whack in a different way when you get above 150, because now you're having such a high pressure force mediated dilatation of the blood vessels, and you can have overflow due to that. And below that, below 50, though, it's basically accepted that you might have an impairment of the cerebral autoregulation and arterial collapse and possibly ischemia. So, Joe, I think you would love this slide. You just talked the other day when we were talking about blood transfusions about Dr. Drew, and I couldn't believe Charles Drew back in 1959 in London. Dr. Drew, it was a cardiac surgeon and is credited with the first successful repair of an ASD and VSD septal defect in between 1970 and 1973. And he operated on infants that were only a few weeks old using profound hypothermia with circulatory arrest and some limited cardiopulmonary bypass. His arrest times were between 38 and 67 minutes. And get this, Joe, 23 out of 24 of his tetralogy cases all survived.
That's impressive.
Mm-hmm.
That's impressive.
So we love to talk about the oxyhemoglobin dissociation curve. So I want you guys to try to keep as much of this in mind as you can as we begin to go through this, because a lot of this comes into play. So there's your oxyhemoglobin dissociation curve. If you look up at the top where it says left, what shifts the curve to the left, which is an increased affinity for hemoglobin, meaning the hemoglobin is going to hold on to the oxygen more tightly and not tend to let it go as easily in the tissues, that's going to shift when it shifts to the left. A decreased temperature, a decreased 2,3-DPG, decreased high, which is increased pH, that will, alkalosis, all are going to increase affinity. To the right is the opposite. A reduction in affinity, increased temperature, increased levels of 2,3-DPG, increased hydrogen ion, which is acidosis. So here's a mnemonic for people that you can use. It says, cadet, turn right, C-A-D-E-T. Carbon dioxide, acid, 2,3-DPG, exercise, temperature, all move the curve to the right. So that's one way you can kind of try to remember some of this. So acid-base management during hypothermia in vivo.
John, John. Yeah, your connection's not good. We keep losing you.
Want me to disconnect and reconnect on my end or something?
Yeah, why don't you do that? Because we're losing you in the middle of it. So let's just take, we'll stay right here. I'll stay with the audience.
Okay.
I'll talk to them while you're doing that. And talk about your slide with the alligator. I saw the alligator. I don't remember what the other one was. Is anybody else? But let's see, what was there? I saw the alligator, and it looks like some kind of marsupial that's hibernating. I'm not sure what it is.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, that's better.
Yeah, you sound better too. You had a strange delay as well on my end, so maybe we got a better connection. You want me to back up a slide or two? Or?
No, I would start with that right there, acid-based management during hypothermia in vivo with your alligator and marsupial.
See, you sound better on my end as well, so hopefully we got a little improvement there. So, well, if you're talking about acid-based management with these animals that we can try to associate, how we should strategize, you have different strategies for different animals. Some must remain active while hypothermic. That's your reptiles there, your alligator, while others go hypothermic during hibernation. Go ahead.
Next slide.
Mm-hmm. So the cold-blooded animals, thermal regulation with cold-blooded animals. These are ectotherms. Their body temperature closely follows their ambient temperature, right? Optimal enzyme efficiency occurs with hypothermia, with them. Intracellular and extracellular pH are allowed to increase in hypothermia. This is the alpha-stat approach, and we're going to talk about this a little bit more elaborately so you can understand it a little more clearly. But then we have, go ahead, Joe, we have the thermal regulation of cold-blooded animals, the ectotherms. Their intracellular pH is very close to the neutral pH of water. Arterial blood pH remains more alkaline than their intracellular pH. There's a constant hydrogen ion gradient across the cell membranes over all temperatures. And this helps eliminate intracellular acids and carbon dioxide. I know that sounds confusing. It's going to get a little more clear. So these animals, the warm-blooded animals, they're in a state of inactivity and metabolic depression. They lower their body temperature, slow their breathing, slow their heart rate, and lower their metabolic rate. So they maintain their arterial pH near 7.40 during hypothermia. Intracellular acidosis leads to a depressed metabolism. This preserves intracellular substrates, and this is what's known as the pH stat approach. So let's look at cerebral autoregulation with regard to carbon dioxide in particular. So carbon dioxide is a potent, direct cerebral vasodilator. It alters your cerebral regulation. Hypercapnia, high CO2 levels, cause dilatation of the cerebral arteries and increased cerebral blood flow. Hypocapnia, of course, causes constriction and a decrease of cerebral blood flow. Now the PCO2 changes during hypothermia. Okay, I see a little graph there. Decreasing blood temperature increases the solubility of carbon dioxide in the blood. As more carbon dioxide dissolves in the blood, this decreases the partial pressure of carbon of the CO2. So if you look at the graph there, solubility of water, this happens to be with water, but it applies to blood and to most fluids. On the y-axis and temperature along the bottom, and it happens to show oxygen there in red and carbon dioxide. Now remember, carbon dioxide is 21 times more soluble than oxygen. So you see it's not very much of a change with oxygen. There's one reason why we don't talk about it all that much. It does occur, but it's slight. But carbon dioxide has a tremendous change over temperature. And that's why we talk about it so much. So PCO2 changes during hypothermia. Blood drawn during hypothermia and then warmed to 37 degrees. This is what happens when you draw a sample from your patient who's hypothermic, and then you take that sample and put it in your blood gas machine. They all warm them up to 37 degrees. Joe, do you know of any machine that you can tell to run it at the temperature of the patient?
I do believe you can do that. I'm not 100% positive, but I'll say I'm 90% that you can do that with the Siemens Rapid Point. You can temperature correct or not temperature correct.
Interesting. Okay. So when you do that, the carbon dioxide that was initially dissolved because you were so cold will now expand, causing an increased PCO2 reading on your blood gas. If it's corrected to the patient's actual temperature, then the result is going to be a reduced PCO2 despite the same CO2 content. So what I'm saying here is that the total carbon dioxide content is going to remain the same because it's shifting from dissolved to undissolved with the PCO2.
Now, I will say that when I do my blood gases, when I've sent them out to the lab, and I'm not positive, I really have to think about this, but I will tell them I do not temperature correct. So I am assuming, you know, and maybe wrongly, that they are running it at the actual temperature. And you know what, John? I don't know the answer to that 100%, but it's a good question.
Do you get a printout back, or do you have to look up your blood gas on the computer?
Those were the days where they would just either send it, call it in. They would call usually, but you could go look it up in the chart later. But generally speaking, no, we didn't have a computer in the room.
Yeah. Well, if you're talking the old days, they had no, the only way to do it was with 37. I think, 99% now still is, but if you ever get a printout, it should always say on there.
Corrected versus uncorrected. And I think that, I think that the rapid point does that. And then maybe the gem and maybe the radiometer do also. But I think you have that as an option. I'm just not 100% positive.
Yeah, me either. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Joe. I think I got our next.
Sorry.
So here we're going to get, if you want a take-home slide, you want to take a screenshot of something, this is a good one for someone to take a screenshot of. You have pH momentum. You have two choices here, right? You have your pH stat on the left side. You have your alpha stat on the right side. So let's just look at the right side for a second. Alpha stat, that's what most of us adult perfusionists are using, right? So if, let's say they're, look at the patient's feet. Let's say the patient's at 28 degrees, right? So on the right side with alpha stat, you take your blood sample, you take it out of your patient, you send it to the lab, and the lab sends you back a wonderful number. You're just doing a great job as a perfusionist because it says you have a pH of 740 and a PCO2 of 40. But if you look down below, the actual pH inside the patient at that temperature, the reality of what's going on in the body, is a pH of 7.56 and a PCO2 of 26. So this is where the pH stat guys come in. What they want to do is they want that 740 and PaCO2 to be what the patient is. They don't want what the laboratory is saying it is at 37. The patient's not at 37. So when you look at the pH side, the guys there, they draw a sample from the patient and they get this terrible number back, 726 PCO2 of 56. But as a temperature corrected value, there it's 740 and a PCO2 of 40. So this is the two sets that you have. And we're going to talk about why would you do one over the other. And the debate has never quite been totally solved. Been raging now for 50, 60 years, right, Joe?
At least.
So the other thing that changes when you drop temperature besides the carbon dioxide is the pH. And the pH doesn't just drop because the carbon dioxide changes. It also drops according to the hydrogen ion. And we're not going to get too deep in the weeds on this because this is a topic that you can get very deep in the weeds on if you choose to. So if you see the graph there that I made, pH is on the y-axis, temperature along the x-axis along the bottom. And at a temperature where I put the arrow in the line there, 37 degrees, in our blood you have a pH of 7.40. But as you cool down, as you go up the red line to the left, the temperature gets colder, 30, 20, 10. You see how the pH changes. That's, we're gonna talk about why that is. The pH gets more alkalotic because there's a shift in the way our buffers behave, our protein buffers behave, okay? So keep those two things in mind. So what's going on here? This is an ionization of the imidazole groups of proteins on histidines. That's a mouthful. And it says that, you know, we have a lot of protein buffers in our plasma, enormous amount. Okay, these are being regulated, and these are one of the major contributors of this hydrogen iron buffering. These are changing their activity as temperature changes as well. So here's the two schools of thought, alpha stat versus pH stat. The alpha stat strategy does not correct for pH or CO2 changes. pH strategy, as I showed in that diagram, does correct for the pH and CO2 changes. And this has been a source of longstanding debate. So let's explore this a little bit further. So let's look at alpha stat. Now, believe it or not, Joe, I don't know if you remember this, but everybody was doing alpha stat way back in the 60s and 70s, and somewhere about 75 to 85, there was a huge paradigm shift in adult perfusion where we switched over and changed to alpha stat. We were doing pH stat. So, and it's just an interesting tidbit there, but it's the most widely used approach for acid-base management in adults. It maintains a normal pH of 7.4, PCO2 of 40, measured at 37 degrees. It's uncorrected for arterial blood temperature. It allows the pH to rise and the PCO2 to fall, as I was just showing you in those graphics, naturally with cooling. You end up with a relative respiratory alkalosis at the patient's body temperature, and you do not add carbon dioxide to the circuit, which is what would happen in a pH stat scenario. We're going to look at that. So again, AlphaStep, alpha, the way they came up with this, it's the ratio of that protonated imidazole that I just mentioned, the imidazole that are attached to the hydrogen on versus the total imidazole, the histidine residues. That's a mouthful. You can research what that means and find out more if you care about that. But it has to do with how much buffering is going on that we have the capability of doing. At 37 degrees, this would equal about 0.55, and that gives you an optimal intracellular enzyme structure and function. And normal intracellular pH would be 6.8. Now you're thinking to yourself, normal pH is 6.8. In intracellular, we have a wide variety of different cells in our body, so I put a little fine print there just to clarify this. Physiologically, normal intracellular pH is most common between 7.0 and 7.4, though there is a variability between our tissues. For example, skeletal muscle tends to have a pH of 6.8 to 7.1. There's also a pH variation across different organelles and cells, which can span from 4.5 to 8.0. So that just clarifies why you can have that type of pH levels intracellularly. Go ahead, Jeff.
Sorry.
So AlphaStat, what are the pros? What are some of the reasons why people will endorse this approach? Well, it preserves your cerebral autoregulation during moderate hypothermia. It avoids luxurious perfusion. It reduces an overflow of cerebral blood flow, which, you know, most people would argue would decrease the risk of microemboli. I'd like to actually have a controversial discussion with you about that statement, Joe, because that keeps coming back up. But let's continue on. Preferable on a cellular level, enzymatic function is well maintained. It's preferable in adults, and it results in better neurocognitive outcome compared to pH that studies have shown in adults for the most part. Go ahead. So what are some of the cons of AlphaStat? It may result in inadequate non-homogeneous brain cooling, something you talked about, Joe, before circulatory arrest. You can also have what's called a steel phenomenon, and this is really in congenital heart surgery, where because of the vasoconstriction and vasodilatation in the pulmonary circulation, vasoconstriction in the cerebral, vasodilatation in the pulmonary circulation, a pediatric perfusionist can be concerned that you would actually have an overflow going into the pulmonary circulation and a lack of adequate flow going to the cerebral in this particular strategy. It may result in cerebral dysfunction in children after cardiac surgery. So like I said, this is really becoming a focus on pediatric perfusion. pH stat, let's look at that. Well, the pH is maintained 7.40 at all temperatures, meaning temperature corrected. It's a traditional acid-based management, as I mentioned, is where perfusion started in the 60s and 70s before it changed. Blood gas analysis is performed at 37 degrees, but then you have to have some, used to be a nomogram years ago. Remember that, Joe? You'd have to look at a nomogram and look at your temperature and find out what your real pH was and your real CO2 was. The blood gas would send it back to you at 37, but if you were at 28, you had to look at your sliding scale and see what your real results were. You added CO2 to the sweep gas, right? Your total CO2 stores are elevated, your CO2 levels are elevated, and it gives you a marked respiratory acidosis at 37 degrees when you warm the blood back up because of that high CO2.
Mm-hmm. Well, we used to use 95.5 out of a tank for our cases in the mid 70s when I started, the mid to later 70s, 1977, but all the way up until the early 80s, and we used 95.5 for that reason. We needed the CO2.
And we used them for bubble oxygenators because they were too efficient on sweep and too inefficient on oxidation. Yeah. So we had to put CO2 for then the bubble oxygenators for that reason. So here's an example of what might happen. Look at the second line first where it says 37 degrees, but your patient's at 17. If you were to draw a blood sample at your patient at 17 degrees, you send it off to the lab and they're gonna send you back 7.06 with a PCO2 of 156. But when you temperature correct it, you really have what you were aiming for if you're a pH stat perfusionist, 740 and a CO2 of 58. And this is what it means by a severe respiratory acidosis at 37 degrees. It increases cerebral blood flow, but you lose your cerebral autoregulation. And that is actually usually a good thing when it comes to peds, and we're going to see that why that is. So here are some of the pH stat pros. It's believed to be beneficial for cerebral vasodilatation, as I just said. It increases your cerebral blood flow, and it's quick and homogeneous brain cooling during the cooling phase of deep hypothermic circulatory rest. Just what you said, Joe, on your talk. But it also maintains your cerebral blood flow. If you keep pH stat going throughout your case, not only are you going to have an initial effect, it's going to maintain your cerebral blood flow. Your oxyhemoglobin dissociation curve is shifted to the right. Some more pros on this. It offers protection in neonatal and infant cardiac surgery. It might inhibit cellular metabolism, meaning slowing the metabolism of the brain is going to be protective, less metabolic rate. It's possibly better for neurobehavior development after circulatory arrest in children, studies have shown. It's particularly beneficial in cyanotic neonates and infants who are basically used to a higher hemoglobin, right, and a higher oxygen transfer. It shifts more cerebral cardiobypass flow towards the cerebral circulation, and as I said, it improves cooling and it improves oxygen supply. So what are some of the cons of doing pH stat? It's slightly greater complex. It's slightly more complex compared to alpha stat strategy, probably not for the people who do it every day, but for those of us who are not familiar. You lose your cerebral autoregulation. This large increase in carbon dioxide is such a powerful vasodilator that it overwhelms your cerebral autoregulatory system, and it's going to keep those vessels dilated. So your cerebral blood flow becomes pressure passive. You flow more, you have higher pressure, you're going to charge a lot of flow right down those cerebral blood vessels. You have luxury brain perfusion and a complete mismatch of cerebral blood flow and cerebral oxygen metabolic demand, meaning way more flow than you actually need. So some people would say that a con of this is an increased risk of cerebral embolization, and certainly, as you talked in your slides show also, Joe, increased possibility of cerebral edema. There's something called a crossover strategy that some people use if you're very sophisticated, I suppose, but I have heard of this in adults. There's people that use a crossover strategy, trying to straddle the best of both of these. In the first 10 minutes of cooling, they'll do a pH stat, followed by continued cooling with alpha stat. Then when they rewarm, they'll use alpha stat. You could dissect out that why that is, but if you look at what they're trying to do, they're trying to improve their cerebral perfusion without overdoing it, and then in the rewarming phase, going back to a more regulated cerebral autoregulation. So blood gas management during hypothermic bypass, why is this more important in children, what we're talking about today? Because we use greater degrees of hypothermia, right? Almost far more than in adults. It results in more profound differences in blood carbon dioxide levels. So let's look at pediatric versus adult cardiac surgery. There's differences in the brain neuroplasticity. Adult brains have an increased neuroplasticity. What is neuroplasticity? It's the ability of your brain to recover from an insult. Children don't have that nearly as well as our developed adult brains do. So they're very susceptible to a slight insult, not being able to recover from it as well. The presence of atherodomous aorta and cerebral embolic load, and the presence of multiple comorbidities in your adults. So here is a paper, and there's many papers, you guys can look this up all day long, but here's one that I've kept coming across. It was done back in cardiovascular thoracic surgery 2010 by Dr. Aziz and his associates, and it asked the question, is pH stat or alpha stat the best technique to follow in patients undergoing deep hypothermic circulatory arrest. Now, this was a review article. They went out and tried to find all the best studies that have been done on adults comparing alphastat and phstat, as well as infants and pediatrics. So they reviewed and found, they had a very strict criteria for the studies that they were going to look at. And they only found 14 that met exactly what they were looking for, because they were trying to look for studies that were going to analyze cerebral metabolism and neuropsychological outcomes. Now, they found 10 adult studies. Seven of those found that alphastat was better than phstat, but three found there was no difference if adult perfusionists used phstat or alphastat. They found four pediatric studies. Three of them found that phstat was better, but one found no difference. Good. So here's a couple conclusion slides if you want to try to bring this all back full circle. So this is a quote from that very same paper. This is in their conclusion statement. In conclusion, there's evidence to suggest that the best technique to follow in the management of acid-base in patients undergoing deep hypothermic circulatory arrest during surgery, cardiac surgery, is dependent on the age of the patient, with better results using phstat in the pediatric patient and alphastat in the adult patient, which is why 99% of us are probably following, if we're an adult or pediatric perfusionist, following what we've outlined here today. Now, here's some other take-home bullet points. Both alpha and phstat management seems to work well. The physiologic differences appear to be actually fairly subtle in most cases. Alphastat may be preferable for adults, protection from microemboli. That's the topic I want to talk to you about, Joe. PHstat seems to be preferable for children because of its enhanced brain protection. And then that crossover strategy that I talked about, where you can combine the two and circulatory arrest in adults, is something that people who are doing this either are doing or could look into. There may be one more slide. And here's some summary statement as well about alphastat, and there's a summary statement about phstat. So alphastat management, which is prevails in reptiles, it aims at maintaining the normal acidemia in the blood and blood gases in the rewarmed blood. In vivo, the hypothermic blood is alkalemic and hypocapnic. Alphastat management preserves autoregulation of the brain perfusion and optimizes cellular enzyme activity. In hypothermia and alkalemia, the oxygen dissociation curve is shifted to the right, resulting in increased affinity for oxygen for hemoglobin, meaning it's not going to release oxygen into the tissues as easily. Therefore, deep temperature reduction, oxygen diluted in the blood at deep temperature reduction, the oxygen that's diluted in the blood represents the main source of oxygen to the tissues. So, Joe, when you were talking about perfusing your brain, your patient's brain, retrograde cerebral perfusion at 17 or 18 degrees and seeing dark blood coming back, the oxygen dissociation curve is so tight to the right, it's probably not releasing a whole lot of oxygen, but the dissolved oxygen in the plasma is probably coming to the rescue in that case and being the main source of oxygen to the tissues.
Well, I would have to disagree with you there, and I'll tell you why. And I'm not necessarily disagreeing with you. I just don't think that that is necessarily the reason, because the PO2 doesn't affect the color differential. It's the saturation, it's the oxygen hemoglobin combination that causes the color difference. So oxygenated blood, saturated hemoglobin is why arterial blood looks red, not the dissolved oxygen in the plasma. So it has to be being released.
That is a very good point. So what this statement here says, that I drew from the article there, it says it represents the main source. So maybe it's 60-40, or maybe it's not, maybe there's still a significant amount of hemoglobin that's able to release oxygen. And then the fact that the temperature is so cold that the dissolved oxygen is also contributing, which normally it probably doesn't hardly do at all, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's only a 3% of oxygen dissolved in plasma. But that'd be an interesting research that somebody could bring to the forefront. I'd be interested to see that.
I think if I ever do another case like that, I'm gonna request, if it's somebody that I work with a lot that would be willing and friendly enough to do this, would be to get a sample of that blood as it's coming back through the arch vessels. Just take a syringe, suck it up, hand it off, and run a gas on it. I think it would be a fascinating number. I think those results would fascinate me. Mm-hmm. So, because we know what's going in, I'd really like to know what's coming out, and it's coming out of the arterial system, and there's no other way for it to get there except from where I'm sending it. So it would be a very specific, precise, there would be very high precision associated with that examination.
Well, so what's interesting is we hear so much about this oxygen dissociation curve, our whole perfusion lives, and it's, you know, we shift it to the right, the hemoglobin's not going to be able to release the oxygen. But, you know, at what point does it actually become terribly relevant? Because, you know, you're seeing this, and we see it in the cardioplegia as well, like I just said before, that the blood comes around these very, very cold organs and tissues, comes around dark. Mm-hmm. So apparently the hemoglobin is still letting go of that oxygen.
Absolutely. And that could be just because we are perhaps not nearly as alkalotic as you think we are.
Right. Because, so if the tissue is acidotic, which it is, that's going to pull that curve back over. So, you know, they're probably ended up being somewhat balanced, and that may be exactly what's happening. Mm-hmm. Here's a general statement similar to the last one in regards to pH stat strategy. It's temperature corrected. pH strategy is the mechanism employed by hibernating animals. So here I want to stop for a second. Humans, I mean, you know, we are not reptiles and we do not hibernate. So which is the strategy that would be best for us? And this is why this debate has been raging for so many years. We don't have it in our DNA or in our development as humans that we've ever had to experience, you know, and become adaptive to any type of hibernation, right? So we don't necessarily know what human beings, what is the right answer for our particular species.
Well,
right?
I would rather mimic another mammal than a reptile. Yeah. Now, there's some people out there that I think probably do mimic reptiles, but we won't get into that conversation.
So the pH management aims at maintaining normal blood gas values at hypothermic temperatures. The pH strategy results in powerful and sustained cerebral vasodilatation due to the high levels of carbon dioxide. Cerebral autoregulation is lost and cerebral blood flow is greatly increased, and resulting in quick and even cooling. When the rewarm blood becomes acidotic and hypercapnic, meaning when you sample it from the patient and you rewarm it in the blood gas machine, you're going to see that. Hypercapnia shifts the oxyhemoglobin to the left and results in an increased availability of the oxygen to the tissue. So here again, we're talking about people who would probably argue in favor and say, well, what you guys were just saying, when you do pH stat, you don't have to worry about the hemoglobin holding onto the oxygen because we have doing a different strategy here. Mm-hmm. And I think that's all I have.
Very good. That was excellent. Very good, John. I mean, that was a really comprehensive, that was a lot more comprehensive on pH and alpha stat, pH stat and alpha stat than I was expecting. It was very, very good, very complete. I have a much better understanding of it, though I don't necessarily think I know which is best at this point. So I'm going to have to think about this for a little while longer. But it was excellent.
So there was two slides there where I said I wanted to kick some things around with you. And what it says, and this also has to do, by the way, with you were talking about the NEARS or running the CASMET or Foresight during your normal bypass patients, or maybe even on ECMO or whatever. People who run cerebral infrared spectroscopy like the CASMET or Foresight, if you do that on all your cases and in normal routine cases, I think you will learn and see that you'll start running higher CO2. levels mm-hmm. on your mm-hmm. on your gases, because it's gonna make you do it, because mm-hmm. you're gonna see patients that the numbers over there, anesthesia is getting nervous. Surgeon looks over the drape, they're getting nervous, wondering what you're doing. You've already increased your flow and done some other things. You run a higher CO2 and you're gonna see better numbers. So you learn to run a higher CO2. In this case here, when we're talking about pH stat and alpha stat, the pH stat guys and gals, they're putting a lot more CO2 into their patient's blood, and so much so that they have wide cerebral vasodilatation to the point where the body's own autoregulation is overwhelmed, and it just goes according to how much CO2 is there and stays vasodilated. And the criticism is, well, and this is what my point was, well, you know, you have to watch out because you're going to possibly have a higher risk of pumping more microemboli because you have a higher flow going to the brain. So my question to you
I guess you could with gases, microemboli, more flow, and maybe knocking off stuff off of the lumen of the, you know, vessels you're cannulated or whatever. I guess that's theoretically possible. You don't have it if you do retrograde, but I don't know. That doesn't really make any sense to me.
Yeah, I had somebody say this to somebody I heard not too long ago. They said, well, I don't use NIRS on my patients because, you know, it tells me to run higher CO2s on my cases, and it opens up the cerebral vasculature. And I think it's a higher risk of perfusing higher microemboli to the brain. And so so let me just ask you a question. Are we pumping microemboli in the first place? Because if you're at cold temperatures and you're at a low flow, we forget about alpha stat, pH stat, or running a NIRS on your patient. If you're at low flow because you're cool, and then you go up to a higher flow because you're warm, how is that any different than doing a little bit higher flow when you're cold in the first place? Why are you saying there's a higher risk of microemboli just because you have a more dilated cerebral vasculature?
Well, I mean,
and you're flowing more.
No, I think
you're flowing more when you're warm.
I mean,
anyway.
I do. Yes, that's true. Of course. I mean, I agree with you. But I mean, I do think that we are, as a general rule, we do expel gaseous microemboli from the pump on a routine basis. I think we know that. I think it's accepted, but I don't necessarily know that there's any clinical relevance to it. I don't think that would be the reason. I think the risk-benefit scale would be imbalanced towards higher risk, less benefit, to constrict the cerebral blood vessels and perfuse the brain with an inadequate amount of oxygenated blood that would still even have microemboli in it, just at a lesser quantity. Than you would have if you had good flow, what it needed, and possibly even luxurious flow. My caveat to that is, I think if you have luxurious flow, you really have to be very careful, and I think you have to be this anyway, about maintaining your COP and maintaining your fluid compartment volumes accurately. Although a little bit drier is always, in my view, way better than a little bit of edematous. I don't think edema is ever good. Right. You know, clearly, you know, tissue dehydration to a point is bad too, but you would rather have a little drier environment. I think it's going to perfuse better. You're going to get better microcapillary perfusion.
Yeah, I think we got a lot bigger fish to fry than worry about if our flow is a little bit higher. And we're somehow pumping micro air emboli anyway. But I wanted to ask you a question back on your presentation as well. When you're doing retrograde cerebral perfusion, are you still running a 1 or 2% on your sevoflurane?
Yeah, I'll put it down to about 0.5%.
Oh, you turn it way down. Okay.
Yeah, I'll run it about 0.5% to 1%. Yeah, I'll turn it down because the metabolism is going to be a lot slow. You know, there's going to be, you know, I don't even know that it has any value, but I will leave it on at a lower level, but I will leave it on.
Well, what about if your COP, you're doing retrograde cerebral and your COP is low, and you want to add some albumin or something? Are you going to add albumin to your reservoir at that low of a flow and it's all going to go to the brain? Or what are you going to do about that exactly?
No, I'm going to tune it up and have it the way I want it before we start that procedure. And then at that point in time, I'm not going to give any agent unless it's a neuroprotective agent that we want to give for some reason. If they wanted to give some more pentothal, usually they don't. But if they wanted to give something, we could do that if it's directly, they want it to go directly into the brain. At that point, I'm not going to give any mannitol. I'm not going to give any albumin. I'm not going to, certainly not going to give any neo. If there's any pressure that I'm not happy with, I'm going to just increase the flow is how I'm going to manage it. Increase or decrease the flow within certain tolerances. I'm not going to go below a certain flow, but I'm also not going to go above a certain flow. Mm-hmm. I'm going to try to figure out why is this happening. And certainly it could be CO2, but generally speaking, you know, I would say the cases have been pretty consistently easy. You know, if you have everything squared away the way you want it, and then you go on circ arrest, the COP isn't going to change.
Yeah.
You know,
no, you had a slide when you talked about it, and I almost got the impression that you were, but I misunderstood your slide then. I had the impression that.
No, I think you need to check it for blood gases and electrolytes to see if anything is changing.
Yeah.
So you want to know. You know, you want to look and see if you have, you want to make sure that your PO2, your PCO2 is where you want it to be. Your pH is where you want it to be. Of course, I like them all to be normal values, which is abnormal at that temperature. I recognize that, but that's what I want. Mm-hmm. I want it to be non-corrected, normal values at the temperature where I am.
Right.
So whichever one that is, I guess that's pH stat. I'm assuming that's pH stat by now. I think I got it right.
I think you're doing alpha stat.
Yeah, it's alpha
using,
stat.
Are you using what the blood gas people send you back? You're using that result they send
no,
you back?
No, I use it corrected to the temperature that I am.
Oh, then that's pH stat, yeah?
Yeah, that's what I want. I want it to be 74040 at the temperature I am, not what it would be if the patient was 37.
Okay, so you have a very nicely vasodilated brain, and that's probably why you're able to flow and perfuse extremely well, because you have the normal content of CO2 that is for at that temperature is a lot of CO2 because so much of it is dissolved now at that temperature, mm-hmm. and you have overwhelmed and overridden your cerebral regulation, which is the point. A lot of people purposely want to do that because of how you're doing it, and you're going to have luxurious cerebral flow. That's for sure.
Right. But I do want a spot check, even though I know it's not going to change. I think it just helps me with validating. I want to make sure that the crit is where I want it. For example, when I do deep hypothermia circulatory arrest, I'll let the crit go down. All the hematocrit down to 16 doesn't bother me. 14 won't bother me. And I will drain blood out of the patient into a bag and replace it. Usually I like to use bicarb-based fluids like the Duasol or whatever, Prismasol or whatever there is out there. There's a lot of them out there that they use in dialysis world that they use for CRRT. I like to use that fluid. You know, it's bicarb-based. I don't dilute anything out. So I'll pull whole blood off, and then I'll dilute the crit down to overwhelm or to manage the increased viscosity that I know is going to happen, and we have good flow. Then when we're warming the patient, as we're warming it increments along the way, I'll add that blood back and ultrafiltrate off, and add that blood back and ultrafiltrate off. And I've done that with up to 2 liters of blood and give it back in 500 cc aliquots. And by the time I come off, we have a hematocrit that's back up to about 30 and maybe 26. If it's lower than that, we're certainly going to transfuse come off pump.
All that sounds extremely familiar, actually. It's extremely familiar. I think when you get really cold like that, it's pretty wise to be pretty diluted because you know what's going on with the viscosity. In fact, one of your slides showed that, didn't it?
Yes.
Well, how the viscosity.
You're really going to have a hard time perfusing the microcirculation, even in the brain, when you have that high a viscosity. And the red cell, you know, deformability is also compromised to some degree. So if you have too much, you can really almost create a dam in some of these capillary beds that are not going to come back until you warm. So that could still happen, but I think it's going to happen to a lesser degree if you are much more hemodiluted, much fewer red blood. So your red cell volume is significantly decreased. That's what I believe.
It's going to make it a little bit more slippery to get through them capillaries, hopefully. But I wanted to ask you something else, too. When you resume full bypass and you're at 17 or 18 degrees, do you stay at that temperature for a period of time before you, like, you stay at 18 degrees for 10 minutes, then you begin the rewarming? Or do you, how much time do you stay?
At least 10 minutes. So I'm going to go, yes, when we restart from Circa Rest, I'm going to keep I will put the heater cooler on 18, keep it at 18 degrees. In fact, I keep it at 18 degrees while I'm perfusing the selective, the isolated cerebral perfusion. I want to keep that brain at the temperature we meant it to be. And then once we've recreated, they've done the proximal portion of the anastomosis, we've transitioned back to normal flow. We've taken the tape off the superior vena cava catheter that I've been using for the retrograde and get good drainage. And that's why I like that big line, because now I'm going to turn my flow up and I'm going to give this patient just a really nice normal blood flow at an index of 2 to 2.2, somewhere in that range, even at 18 degrees for 10 minutes. And then I'm going to turn my temperature up to the appropriate level for rewarming at the rate that I want to rewarm. Keep that gradient at 10 degrees or less.
Yeah, that's excellent.
That's what I do. And I have, look, I've had really good, listen, man, I haven't done one of these cases in a while now, but I mean, of the last, you know, 10, 15, 20, I guess, that I've done, they've all done great. And, you know, we had good surgeons. They weren't like super fast. They weren't like big time aortic surgeons. These were regular kind of guys that did CABGs, valves, things like that. No, they were pretty talented. They were good surgeons. But all of the patients did really well. And I think that the way I did it, the way I was able to, because I worked in a place that they really sort of just deferred to us. And if it made sense to them, they were good with it, and the outcomes were good. So there was never, what's there to complain about, right? It's all about the outcomes at the end of the day. You're only as good as your last right decision. That's the nature of this business. So when people give you autonomy, especially when they are from a positional perspective, a rank perspective, higher rank than you, and they give you autonomy. In this case, surgeons and perfusionists, we may be colleagues, but you know, we're the lieutenants and they're the colonels. So, you know, you have to, or general, and we're the whatever, majors, however you want to couch this, doesn't make any difference. You're only going to be as good as your last right decision. And so having autonomy is a great thing, and being respected as a professional is a great thing. And having people listen to your opinion and value it and follow the suggestions you're giving is a great thing, but it comes with an enormous burden and responsibility that you can't take too lightly, because we're dealing with people and their life, their brain. This is a serious business. And I think sometimes that's not always remembered. And I don't mean that in a negative way to knock perfusion. I think perfusion is a wonderful profession. I think I have some incredibly talented, look at you. We've got some incredibly talented, caring professional colleagues, a lot of them out there, okay? The overwhelming majority, for sure. But we don't see these people. We don't talk to the patient beforehand. We don't get to know their family beforehand. We don't see them postoperatively or rarely do we. We don't see them on the follow-up visits. We don't have that connection. And sometimes I think we lose sight of you know, how truly important our jobs really are. What we do is meaningful. And you gotta be right. You can't do guesswork. You gotta do your research. You have to have a foundation for why you're doing what you're doing. And you know what? If something goes awry and doesn't work out well, it's not because you did something wrong. I think that's really the point. Through a lack of knowledge.
Have you ever seriously asked yourself this question? What if, as perfusionists, we had to talk with the family, every family, after every case? We had to go and talk with the family. That was part of our job. Mm-hmm. Would that not turn your perspective of what we do on its head if you had to talk with every family that we did, that you pumped?
Would it turn my perspective on its head? Probably not. But I think it would be a, I think it would help to reinforce, because I, like I said, I think the overwhelming majority of the people that we work with, you know, we are sort of in the background, we're kind of quiet, we're there. Nobody really knows what the heck we're doing back there. You know, that it's almost like an enigma. It's really strange. But it has profound impact. So I think it would, benefit us as a profession if we did that, but I don't necessarily think it's necessary. I think we can, you know, we can be sensitive to that without actually talking with the patient. I just think that we need to be more keenly aware of the need to be sensitive to it, because you can get to the point where it's just another case, you know. They got a bump in their creatinine. We've all been there. Especially if you've been doing this for any length of time. I've had my moment. I've had my time in this profession of, you know, going through the motions. But I think by and large, I recognize that what we do matters tremendously to people, and that Not just living through the operation, but being a normal functioning, the same person they were when they came in, for them and their families really matter, really matters.
Well, that's what I mean. We would see, you know, an awful lot of good, might even be more gratifying. We would see the people who just had, you know, the temporary, you know, a pump head, as they used to call it. We'd see people that had, you know, some slight permanent deficits, like their short-term memory just wasn't nearly as what it once was. And then we would see the things that maybe are more serious. But we're probably 95% or more blinded to especially the long term. We don't see patients in the long term ever. And a lot of people don't even hardly go over to check on their patients in the ICU anymore. We used to do that. Every morning you'd go see your patient from the previous day and just ask the nurse how they did. And you might even do it on the second day. But after that, but do we really know what the patient comes back into the doctor's office 30, 60 days later and 6 months later? And you know, we were totally unaware. And we probably had a big role in a lot of what these patients experienced, good and bad.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm going to argue with you about one thing. Pump head is not caused by the pump. It's caused by the surgeon. Don't forget that. I want to say something though. Pedro Lucas. I'm gonna send you a messenger thing. He said to us, "Excellent. Once again, it's 1 a.m. here, and I'm watching you guys. This means something. Congratulations, Pedro. Thank you very much. That's kind and generous of you, and we appreciate those kinds of comments. And also, I can't pronounce this name, so forgive me. I'm trying to make it simple as I can during DHCA. I think that makes a lot of sense, Raf. I think keeping it simple does make sense. And for me, the simplest approach is to put that bridge from the arterial to venous line, clamp proximal to the oxygenator, and clamp the inferior vena cava line, atrial vena cava line, and just pump straight up there, go retrograde through a 22 French, make sure the tapes are on, flow, a good flow, use TCD. It sounds like it complicates things, but it's gonna make you feel a lot better about what you're doing. I just wish it would become more of a standard of care. John, you want to close up with any closing remarks?
Well, I actually, when you wanted to ask you about the TCD, because I remember years ago, didn't we used to monitor the middle cerebral artery? Isn't that what the TCD aim it towards?
It does, and you look at them bilaterally, and you can visualize both of them. You can visualize both from one side. You can actually see through to the other side. But they have two channels. We'd need to get Dr. Gourami back here to do this because he really understands it way better than I do. But Bob Groom talked about it for years. It's not really it's really never been widely adapted into the cardiovascular world. And a lot of the reason for that is because there's a new device out that is automated. It's like a robot, but it occupies a lot of geography up here. And you know how anesthesia is about stuff. But the old style, you had to get it up there and you had to aim it and you had to get it set. But once it's set, as long as nobody hits it, you're not going to have any problems. It'll stay where it needs to be. It's kind of a headband that goes on with the probes here in the what they call the temporal window area. But you can also put it in the carotids. You can put it up like this. You can do eyeball. There's other ways to do it to view other things. But again, that takes a little more expertise. This, the temporal window version, is very simple.
Well, hasn't a version of it been around for many, many years? Because I did a paper back, I want to say, in 1989, I had a case report. Surgeon came to me and said, look, we've got this patient. He has bilateral 100% total occlusions of the carotids, and this is not going to be a carotid arterectomy. It's too late for that. The patient is actually relatively fine. He had some dizzy spells and things like that, but he didn't actually stroke out. He was surviving on his vertebral arteries and collaterals that had developed apparently over the years. But we were going to put this patient with 100% total carotid stenosis on bypass, and we had the idea of creating a pulsatile flow with the balloon pump. We actually put a balloon pump catheter in this patient for the purpose of pulsatile flow, and we did a middle cerebral artery. I want to say it was a TCD, but it was a single probe. I think we put it near the temporal area, and we got a great visual of the entire case that we were perfusing the brain, and this patient did extremely well.
You were way ahead of the curve then, John, because it is not widely accepted. And I really, like I said, want it to be. Please help me. I'm going to get you. I think you might have Dr. Gourami's email address. We need to send him an email, and we need to get him scheduled to come back here. He's been here once before, and do a review on it again for us. And really talk about the simplicity. Talk about it from an actual making it happen perspective. Maybe do two parts. Do one about the value of it, and do one about the how do you do it. Do it. You know, just the directions, the recipe, and how do we overcome this never-ending turf war that exists almost everywhere I have ever been. Between anesthesia and anybody else that gets up in their zone, because it's not beneficial. We're all there for the same purpose. So I never really understood that. Now it doesn't happen with everybody. I mean, there's a lot of anesthetists who are really kind of cool, and they we'll do this. I'm referring more towards the MD anesthesia that seemed to have difficulty with anybody doing anything like that.
So you're proposing that it should be done on all your circulatory arrest cases.
I think it should be done on every case that goes on bypass. I think it should be done on every off pump case. I think it should be done routinely on any case where you're screwing around with the cardiovascular system and have episodes of hypoperfusion. You know, could you imagine putting a stabilizer on the heart, pulling the heart over with that suction that they put on the apex and lifting the heart up to get the circ or the OM, and anesthesia's over there, bam, 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 and you've got this great looking blood pressure, but you're doing a TCD and you literally have no cerebral blood flow. Or trickling. So, how many times does that happen and we don't know it? And then everybody wonders, why did this patient have a neurologic consequence? What happened here? some type of event happened. But what was it? We had a great blood pressure the whole time. Blood pressure, I said it the other day, blood pressure and perfusion are not equal. They're not the same thing. I can give you a great blood pressure with a cardiac output of 1 liter a minute. I can make your blood pressure look fantastic.
Right.
So
I was going to call on that. That was a good show. I think it was yesterday, was it? That was a great, pressure equals flow times resistance. So you could have a very, very high resistance and a tiny, tiny flow, and your pressure looks great. You know, we focus way too much on numbers. And if the numbers are good, that means everything must be okay. That you have to look at the patient, and you have to think about the physiology and the anatomy of what are we doing right at this moment in time to this patient, and does it make sense?
Absolutely. You know? And looking at the flow, seeing it on a monitor, the actual flow, the velocity, right, the perfusion. I mean, yes, we're there to perfuse the whole body, but you know, the brain, it's like the big deal. You know, the brain is the most sensitive organ of all to hypoperfusion. And we use these stickers on the head that supposedly look through skin, tissue, fluids, bone, and everything else to get to the brain. Does it really get to the brain? You know, it's a debate that's going to rage on forever. But, I don't know. I don't think it does. But, John, we've run out of time. I hate to do this to you, but we've run out of time. I need to tell everybody that we will see you tomorrow. John, you're going to be back tomorrow. As a matter of fact, tomorrow you are going to be talking about roller versus centrifugal pumps. I can't believe there are still people that use roller pumps, but I'm fascinated by that topic. And I'm going to be talking about basically measurement of how do we measure the adequacy of our perfusion. And it's pretty basic. I think it's going to be pretty simple, but it'll be fun. We'll make it enjoyable. I'm looking forward to hearing your talk. And then we're going to do just a 20-minute back and forth on what is perfusion. Is it a career or a job? And I think we've already laid the groundwork for that here tonight, John. So we'll see you tomorrow. Same time, same station. Thanks a lot. Peace out.
Later.